Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello, and thanks for joining us on If You Love This Planet. My guest on the show today is the wonderful Naomi Klein, award-winning journalist, columnist, and author. Naomi writes a regular column for The Nation and The Guardian, and her new book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, is a New York Times and international bestseller. Her previous book, No Logo, Taking Aim at the Brand Bullies, was also an international bestseller, translated into over 28 languages with more than a million copies in print. In 2004, Naomi released The Take, a feature documentary about Argentina's occupied factories, co-produced with director Avi Lewis. The film won the Best Documentary Jury Prize at the American Film Institute's Film Festival in Los Angeles. She's a former Millibrand Fellow at the London School of Economics and holds an honorary Doctor of Civil Laws from the University of King's College, Nova Scotia. Naomi Klein, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
It's an honor to speak with you, Helen.
Thank you, Naomi. Our history goes back a little, doesn't it?
You are kind of an honorary member of my family. Well, my mother, Bonnie Klein, is a documentary filmmaker, and she was one of the producers of the film, If You Love This Planet. And the film, if You Love This Planet, for people who haven't seen it, is a lecture by Helen Caldicott, intercut with old Ronald Reagan war movie footage, and it won the Academy Award. So it was certainly a big deal in my life as a teenager that I had some sort of tangential relationship to that film.
Well,
then my brother became a peace activist. He started a student group called Students Against Global Extermination, which is, you know, it's a clunky name, but it had a good acronym. The acronym was SAGE. And it also worked in French because I grew up in Montreal, so everything needs to be bilingual. So it was Students Against Global Extermination, and in French it was Solidarité Anti-Guerre Étudiante, and it was SAGE. And they went on this cross-country tour in a red station wagon, going from school to school to talk about the threat of nuclear war, and the centerpiece of their presentation was showing If You Love This Planet. Now, I at the time was a mall rat, just going shopping and, you know, smoking pot. So I can't say I contributed in any way.
Well, Naomi, that was probably a good preparation for the work you had in hand. Because your books are turning the world upside down. Now, this particular book, The Shock Doctrine, which I read a couple of months ago, it's very long, but it's incredibly good and powerful because I'm updating my book, If You Love This Planet, in preparation for that. And I, even though I know a lot, it absolutely took my breath away. And I want to start first with you describing this guy, Dr. Cameron, at McGill University, and that he was working with the CIA, and what years were they, and what, in a short little précis, just tell us what he did with his patients.
Well, this dates back to the 1950s, and Ewan Cameron was really the most powerful psychiatrist in the world at the time. He had been head of the American Psychiatric Association, the World Psychiatric Association, and he moved to Canada because he was made head of the psychiatry at McGill University, and he was head of the hospital associated with McGill, the mental hospital associated with McGill, the Allen Memorial Hospital, and he was I think he was something of a sick man. Mm-hmm. He believed that the cure for mental illness, any kind of mental illness, psychiatric problem that he was presented with, from anxiety to sexual dysfunction, that the cure was not to do therapy. He was disdainful of what he called talk therapy, and disdainful of the Freudian approach, which was the dominant approach at the time. And he believed that the solution was to use massive doses of electroshock and very odd cocktails of drugs, uppers and downers simultaneously, with the explicit goal of reducing his patients to the state they were in when they were born. It was sometimes, some of these psychiatrists call this process rebirthing. So essentially what he's saying is, it's all the mother's fault. Let's start over. Let's take this adult and turn them into a baby. And he didn't consider his therapy successful until his patients had lost their ability to speak and were doubly incontinent. That was his goal. And then he started what he called repatterning. That was depatterning. This was repatterning, or psychic driving, where he would play tape-recorded messages over and over and over on an endless loop through headphones, telling these blank sheets of people, these blank slates that he had just reborn, all of this in quotes, that they were, you know, the kind of person that he wanted them to be. Now, this was an absurd psychiatric method, but it was the 1950s, and it caught the attention of the CIA, because the CIA had launched this program called MKUltra, which was focused on new torture techniques. They were researching ways of breaking down prisoners. It was in the context of the Cold War. So they started funding Cameron, and he started taking these treatments into bold new territory using PCB and LSD. And I should say, I know this is sounding really out there. All of this is proven. There have been many books written about it, and there's been a lawsuit. There was a successful lawsuit by 9 of Cameron's former patients who successfully sued the CIA. They were the first people to successfully win a lawsuit against the CIA. So this is not science fiction. This is what happened in the 1950s. And what we found out later is that the techniques that Cameron used were codified by the CIA in their interrogation manuals, which weren't declassified until the late 90s. And so in the book, I quote extensively from these manuals where they refer specifically to the McGill experiments, to extreme sensory deprivation, extreme sensory overload. And what's interesting about the CIA interrogation manual, and this is really a torture manual, and we see the techniques used in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, is that it's the same idea that, of regression. And this was Cameron's obsession, turning adults into children or even into babies. And the CIA manuals start with this preface that say every technique we're about to describe is essentially a technique for inducing regression, because when the regress state is achieved, that's when the prisoner is most likely to comply with the wishes of their interrogator. I should say the book is not about torture. It's actually about economics, but this ended up being this incredible sort of metaphor for economic shock therapy, as well as physical shock therapy.
Okay. I'm interviewing Naomi Klein, the author of this wonderful book, The Shock Doctrine. Now, Naomi, move from Cameron's deprocessing of his patients, the CIA involvement, Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, and move from that theory or practice into how it was translocated into what people do or America does with nation states, and talk about Milton Friedman, the Chicago School of Economics, what his theory was, and combine the two, which you've done in your book.
I started to research these psychiatric shock techniques because I had been in Iraq in the first year of the occupation. Mm-hmm. And I was just so overwhelmed with the fact that shock seemed to be the metaphor for everything that was happening in that country. It was the invasion was called shock and awe, and it was deliberately an attempt to simulate the effects of Hiroshima and Nagasaki to create an absolute and total annihilation of the country and a psychological attack on the population. And then it was immediately followed by a Paul Bremer arriving to impose the most radical a dose of economic shock therapy, what economists call economic shock therapy, to radically remake Iraq's economy. And the theory was that they would be able to harness this window of opportunity and the aftermath of the shock and awe to push through economic shock therapy, that Iraqis would be too disoriented to resist. Now, of course, that didn't work, and the war was moved into the jails, and thousands of Iraqis were rounded up, and they were they met with non-metaphorical shocks. Torture became systematic. So when I came back from Iraq, I wanted to understand where these shock ideas came from, and so I end up tracing the origins of both the physical shocks back to Cameron and McGill and these laboratories for the CIA, and also to the University of Chicago in the 1950s, in the same era, where you had the laboratory for what would later become economic shock therapy, because the U.S. State Department funded a very ambitious program. I think many of your listeners have heard of the so-called Chicago Boys in Latin America. A lot of people think that the Chicago Boys are actually from Chicago, and they're U.S. advisors that went to Latin America to work with Pinochet. That's not the case. The Chicago Boys are Latin Americans. They are Chileans, Argentinians, Mexicans, who were brought to the University of Chicago by the under this U.S. State Department program and later by the Ford Foundation to study under Milton Friedman and his colleagues at the University of Chicago Economics Department, precisely because in the 50s and 60s, this was considered to be the most radical right-wing school in the world. And it's worth remembering that at this stage, the United States was very much a Keynesian country. This was the era of Keynesian economists and Kennedy's action intellectuals, and Milton Friedman and his idea that, you know, the only acceptable role for the state was just to protect the borders, and that everything should be privatized from the post office to national parks, was considered absolutely, you know, loony. Mm-hmm. But the U.S. State Department saw this as a tactic, in that Latin America was moving very much to the left in this period, as it is today. And so the idea was to take this batch of Latin American students, train them in this far-right ideology so that they would be a counterpoint to their left-wing colleagues in their respective countries. Now, when they were turned in the 50s and 60s and tried to win a battle of ideas with the left in Latin America, they lost completely, because Latin Americans kept electing left-wing governments. Mm-hmm. And the most dramatic case of this was the election of Salvador Allende, who was a doctor, and you know, a social democrat who believed in imposing a socialist vision, but peacefully and democratically, and it wasn't a purist vision. It had room for the market. And he was overthrown violently in 1973, and Pinochet came to power
by the CIA.
The CIA was certainly involved in subsidizing the opposition movements in Chile for years leading up to the coup.
Yeah,
and they also subsidized the Chicago Boys, these economists who actually developed an economic program for the military government well before the coup. And this is what I show in the book, is that this wasn't just a military coup. This was actually an economic and military coup. And both sides were doing their own preparations.
And wasn't it American rockets that hit Allende's palace and killed him, with 24 rockets or something were fired? And
24 rockets, but they actually were Chilean planes. I'm not sure about I wouldn't be at all surprised if the make of the rockets. You know, there continues to be a debate about how Allende died, and the debate isn't settled, but obviously he wouldn't have died were it not for the coup.
I knew a colleague of his who was with him when he died, who was also a physician, and he told me how he died. Tragic. I mean, it just made me weep.
Yeah, it was absolutely tragic. You know, one of the things that's so amazing about Allende's last hours is he did this final radio broadcast by phone, speaking to the nation and telling the country that no matter what happened and no matter who died, that the ideas that they believed in were so powerful that they would survive.
Mm.
And what he said was true. The ideas were so powerful, and that's why such a tremendous amount of force was required to uproot them.
Mm.
And, you know, one of the most controversial parts of my book is that I talk about the interrelationship, the partnership between the economists and the torturers in countries like Chile.
Describe Naomi.
Well, in Chile, after the coup, you had several of the key Chicago boys ascending to central roles in the government, ultimately rising to finance minister, head of the central bank. You know, they were making the policy for Pinochet, and they turned the country into this laboratory for these Chicago school ideas. You know, they did everything, flat tax, privatized Social Security, stuff Bush still can't do. They were doing in the
70s.
What
else? Name the rest that they did.
Oh, they privatized everything from the zoo to kindergartens. They imposed free trade policies, privatizations. I mean, it's 30-40% cuts to healthcare and education. So, you know, we didn't have a name for this yet, but this was to be the prototype of what later would be benignly called globalization. But at the same time, the left in Chile was brutally rounded up, assassinated in football stadiums, disappeared into torture centers like Via Grimaldi, and Pinochet made sure that, you know, for Pinochet, this brutality was very public, in the sense that he was really into the demonstration model of showing everyone in the country, you know, this is what happens. It was truly rule by terror. You know, when you think about the National Stadium and Chile Stadium and the summary executions, bodies turning up on the side of the road, the way in which people were kidnapped and brought to the torture centers in broad daylight so all the neighbors could see. So it wasn't just about how many people were disappeared, how many people were tortured. It's that the entire country was being sent this message. And, of course, thousands of Chileans left the country, leftist Chileans left the country. So, you know, what I argue in the book is that, of course, this was connected, because you could never have turned Chile into a laboratory for these right-wing ideas without a strategy for erasing the left. And that strategy had to be brutal, precisely because of what Allende said in his final radio address, because these ideas are so deep and are so deeply felt.
The ideas of compassion and caring for each other, which is really the essence of Christianity and most other religions, in fact, is caring for each other. I'm speaking to Naomi Klein, the author of The Shock Doctrine, and she's describing some of the information that she's put in the book. Naomi, to get back to Milton Friedman, he seems like a psychologically deranged man. How could he possibly think that the free market system, in other words, greed, and only thinking of oneself, would be good for everyone else, which is really the sort of basis of his theory, wasn't it?
The basis of the theory is, when you try to do good, when you try to help people, you end up doing bad.
But how does he describe how you do bad by helping other people?
You interfere in the natural communication of the market. For Friedman, he fetishized the market like it was this sort of great symphony, and, you know, supply communicates with demand the way the moon pulls the tides. And so anything that governments would do to try to help people interfered with these signals that were being sent. So you end up doing bad. So to try to do good is to do bad, and to follow your own greed, which many people describe as bad,
is
to do the ultimate amount of good. You know, this is a theory. It's entirely counterintuitive.
It's 1984, isn't it? It's George Orwell.
Well, I mean, you know, you wonder why this movement needs, you know, so many think tanks, right, which are entirely outside the free market, right? I mean, these are thinkers who are kept in tanks, and, you know, they're funded by their corporate keepers. Their ideas don't sell in the free market. But it's because it's hard work trying to keep people it's hard work trying to indoctrinate people in something so counterintuitive, that trying to do good is bad and doing bad is good.
Or so wicked. I mean, so wicked, really.
You know, Helen, one thing I wanted to raise with you, too, is, you know, one of the things that really strikes me, you mentioned him being deranged. You know, I'm so struck by, I mean, this idea of the curing through shock, right? I mean, it's the ultimate failure of the imagination. You've got a problem. Rather than deal with the problem, just blank it, erase it, start over. You know, that's what Cameron wanted to do with his patients. That was the theory of warfare in Iraq. It's the theory of nuclear war. But one of the things that's so amazing to me about these economists is that they insist on casting themselves as doctors. you know, Milton Friedman, when he was challenged about the ethics of working with Pinochet, he said, well, I'm no different than a physician going to a country that is suffering from an epidemic and offering medical advice. And this constant casting of oneself as the doctor. So I think it would be very good for doctors to speak out against this sort of misuse of the profession, actually.
The guy was a nut. I mean, I probably shouldn't say that on air, but, you know, logically, reasonably, morally, he was... I wonder what his childhood was. I mean, be interesting to see his neuroses and how his mother and father treated him and where this deranged notion came from. But the most important, it's kind of, he wasn't a Hitler, but, you know, Hitler was severely deranged too. People who do these really evil things, and Milton Friedman did evil things in many countries of the world, and it goes on. You know, often they've had disturbed childhoods, not that many of us haven't anyway, but they've reacted in such a way to project their disturbance and power onto other countries. So that's a statement that many people won't like me making, but it's true. And so what are the other countries apart from Chile, Brazil, Argentina?
Well, Russia is another case.
Russia,
where, I mean,
yeah.
I think that the violence, you know, of the economic model and also the overt violence hasn't received nearly enough attention. And I think it explains why we've ended up with a return to authoritarianism in Russia. You had, you know, in the late 80s and early 90s, a really inspiring process, which, of course, you know, you were very involved in with perestroika and glasnost and, you know, a democratization process happening in Russia under Gorbachev. It should have had the support of the world.
Yep.
And for a while there, it seemed that it would, right? I mean, Gorbachev was just the toast of the town.
He still is the toast of the world, but not in Russia. It's interesting.
Well, now he is, yeah. But he certainly fell out of favor with the West for a while. And, you know, Gorbachev's vision was first democratize the Soviet Union, introduce this opening up, this democratization. And his vision for the economic side was that it had to be very gradual, to transitioning from a state-controlled authoritarian system. He thought it would take about 15 years, and his vision was social democracy on the Scandinavian model. This was his vision. And, you know, it may well have been possible if he had received the support that was required. There would have needed to have been real debt, massive debt forgiveness. There needed to be aid. There needed to be real backing. But this was, you know, the early 90s. So it was really the moment of high hubris for the globalization mythology, right? So he goes to, and, you know, this is the moment where people talked about a Washington consensus with a straight face. And Francis Fukuyama and the end of history, you know, we're all at this. It was that moment.
Yeah.
And he went to the G8 and he laid out his plan for a gradual transition. And he was told that under no circumstances would he get any support and that the only method that would be accepted was shock therapy, shock therapy.
So the G8, who was actually the thinker? Who were the people, the powers behind the G8 that had the authority to say that to Gorbachev at that point in history?
Well, I mean, this was the G8 of John Major, Brian Mulroney. It was a very right-wing G8. Actually, Bush Sr. was still in power, although Clinton's Russia policy was disastrous and continued along the exact same lines. The only person who spoke up for him was Chirac. And what was interesting, but Gorbachev was beside himself because he was saying, look, all of your countries have versions of what I'm trying to build in Russia. You know, none of you have a pure, absolute free market. You all have mixed economies. You all have elements of socialism in your economy. You know, talking to Canada, you know, we have a public health care system.
Yes.
We have a public education system. But they wanted Russia to be their laboratory. They didn't want any compromise. It was shock therapy or nothing. So in terms of where the power was, a lot of it was with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, who were at their most ideologically zealous.
And the IMF and the World Bank, Naomi, bought the Friedman ethic, right?
Absolutely. I mean, they hired Chicago boys by the bushel. And this became the orthodoxy of these institutions, which is incredibly ironic because these are institutions that were formed in the aftermath of the Second World War,
yep.
precisely to avoid the kinds of economic shocks and crises that created the context for fascism to rise in Europe, because it was deeply understood that there was a connection, just as Keynes had said, between the economic punishment in Russia and the rise of Nazism.
You mean the economic punishment in Germany and the rise of that?
Sorry, where did I say?
You said yeah. Russia.
Sorry. And so, but by the early 90s, the IMF and the World Bank were highly ideological and openly signed on to what was called the Washington Consensus, which was privatization, deregulation, cuts to government spending, preferably done through shock therapy.
Okay, so that's Russia, and it turned out to be just absolutely ghastly, with billionaires stealing the oil, stealing the forests, stealing everything from the people paying the billionaires to have this money, and then corruption, homeless people, people starving the streets for the first time, and total chaos. And then, of course, Yeltsin went in to remove people's vision about what was happening to Chechnya and started killing people there, and he killed up to 250,000 people as a sort of little sideshow.
And when the Russian parliament said enough,
yes.
We don't want any more shock therapy,
yeah.
He called in the tanks, and there was
yeah.
a coup
yeah.
in Russia. They dissolved the parliament, they arrested the parliamentarians, and had a period of unchecked dictatorial rule, and it was in that period when the most radical reforms took place. And I have this quote in my book from a World Bank, from the head of the World Bank mission in Moscow, the night that Yeltsin called the tanks in on the parliament.
Yeah.
And he said, "I've never had so much fun in my life," was his quote.
God.
What I'm trying to do here is tell an alternative history of what in many parts of the world is called neoliberalism, and other parts of the world is globalization, because we're told that this has been a peaceful process, and that's just a lie. And so I'm trying to retell this story with the coups and the massacres and the torture and the terror left in, because I think only when we do that are we able to see Iraq in its proper context, which is not an aberration, but a culmination of a 35-year process.
A classic example. I mean, you, in your book, not just, you go through the Asian tigers collapse in the mid and late 90s, where the IMF and the World Bank, I think, pulled out support and their markets collapsed, except Malaysia, who didn't go along with the IMF
yeah.
and World Bank. And their economy
and
survived.
Yeah.
China, you point out, you know, with the man standing in front of the tank, where, you know, there was a point where China had to decide whether to continue its communist era or go into the neoliberalism economy, which they've done with a vengeance. And now there are people working on an absolute shoestring, and there are people, there'll be starvation in China and the like. You know, everything that was set up, although they're doing well economically, but they're polluting themselves unto death.
I mean, what China shows us, I think, and it's really important to talk about this as much as we can, is that this is the most convincing challenge to this fairy tale that free markets and free people go hand in hand.
Yeah.
Because the truth of the matter is that the most successful capitalist economy, successful by capitalist terms, by GDP growth, is a communist police state. And this has been the case now for close to a decade.
What, you mean China?
China. China is the most successful capitalist economy in the world. And it is successful precisely, I would argue, not despite the fact that they don't have political freedoms, but because of that lack of political freedom.
Okay, yeah. Naomi, describe how that is so, that when you've got people who I guess are totally controlled and repressed by their communist state, who've moved into the capitalist system, why is that successful and how?
Well, it's successful on capitalist terms because, well, on one level, because independent trade unions are still banned in China.
Yeah.
So you can keep wages artificially low. You don't have that natural evolution that happens when workers gain confidence and start organizing. They're brutally repressed.
Mm.
So this has turned China into the workshop of the world. And in the Pearl River Delta, where I recently visited, basically half of everything probably most people listening own was made there.
Mm.
I mean, iPods, computers, your clothing, there are more than 100,000 factories in this one area. So it's not, despite the repression, which is how it's often presented, or as if China's on some road, some gradual road to democracy. It's precisely the willingness of the state to prevent that counterpoint from emerging, that counterpoint to the power of business, that has made China so profitable. It's also so profitable because, you know, if they want to build a new export processing zone or a new shopping mall,
they just can.
They can just level the village, right? A new dam. I mean, there's no, and there'll be a protest, and that protest will be repressed, and the village people will be given some money. But it's far more conducive to this sort of rapid development than democracy, which takes time and is messy, and you don't always win.
Well, what's happening to the people in China, though, Naomi? Are the conditions ghastly? What about their healthcare system? I mean, what is this system, what impacts is it having upon the population in China, apart from the pollution where they can hardly breathe?
Yeah, which is just staggering. Mm. And also, you know, it's an incredibly opaque state in terms of information about these very questions. And you know, this is one of the freedoms that that they lack is journalistic freedom.
Mm.
And, you know, what struck me most on my recent reporting trip to China is really that it is two countries now, at least two. Mm. But there are real winners from this economic model. There is an elite now in China that is actually very afraid of democracy coming. And this is the China that's buying cars and condominiums and enjoying a level of luxury completely unknown to their parents. There's a real fear among China's new elite that there would be democracy and that they would have to share, because I think it's very frightening, you know, how populous the country is. And so what you have is an institutionalized two-tiered citizenship. China has 130 million migrants, people who are what they call the floating population. And these are precisely the people whose villages were razed, who lost their lands to some new development project, and they're not able to live in villages anymore, and so they move to the cities. But the way the Chinese system works is that it's while it's easy now to move to look for work, it's very, very hard to get residency status in the city. So these migrant workers, this floating population, is free to work, but they aren't free to get the benefits of full citizenship in their new location. Mm. So they're sort of ghosts. They're sort of shadows. They don't get free health care. Their kids can't afford to go to school. They have, they're denied some rights. So in many ways, they're kind of like the Mexicans in the U.S. economy, except for it's an internal system, an internal sort of illegal immigrant system within one country.
Now, can you just briefly describe what happened in Sri Lanka after the tsunami? You went there. Tell us about private corporations moving in there and the way disaster capitalism works in the face now of more and more disastrous events related to global warming, Naomi Klein.
Yeah. It was Sri Lanka that actually made me write the book. I had been doing reporting on Iraq, but I wasn't planning to write a book. And I went to Sri Lanka 6 months after the tsunami hit, and I was researching the reconstruction process there. And I had been in Iraq recently, what I found was so similar, that's when I first used the phrase disaster capitalism. And what I mean by that is that you had this, obviously, a natural disaster, and this outpouring of public giving mm-hmm. around the world. It broke all charitable records. People just wanted to help, and they mm-hmm. just wanted the people who they saw on television to be able to rebuild their modest homes, get a new boat, and just help in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And what actually happened in Sri Lanka was quite the opposite. First of all, the government in that country and in many of the tsunami-hit areas passed laws forbidding people to rebuild on the beach in the coastal areas, and they said that this was for their safety. So when I arrived in Sri Lanka, hundreds of thousands of people were being warehoused in these camps built by NGOs quite a ways inland. And they were overwhelmingly fishing people, small boat fishing people, which meant that they had absolutely no way of making a living, because they need the water to make a living, and they couldn't access the water. So they were really trapped. They were like prisons. And meanwhile, on the coasts, inside what they called the buffer zone, where no one was supposed to build, there was a huge amount of construction going on. And these were luxury hotels from Singapore and the U.S. And I interviewed the head of the World Bank mission in Sri Lanka, who told me, quite casually, that his vision for Sri Lanka was for it to be the next Bali. And you know, the tsunami had provided this opportunity because it had cleared the beach. It had cleared the beach of all of these inconvenient people with their inconvenient homes and their inconvenient boats, and it was a blank sheet. And so that was happening on the coast. Meanwhile, in the capital, there was a frenzy of lawmaking. There was a major push on from USAID, from the World Bank, for Sri Lanka to accept all of these neoliberal reforms, water privatization, electricity privatization, labor market reform. And what was so striking about it is that there had been elections in Sri Lanka only 8 months before the tsunami, where they had voted out, Sri Lankans had voted out a neoliberal government that was trying to do all of these privatization plans. And so the tsunami was just overtly being used to subvert this democratic process. And, you know, that's what I mean by disaster capitalism.
And that's what happened in New Orleans, right?
And then it happened again in New Orleans.
They warehoused the people, particularly if they were black and poor.
Well, they spread them out through every state in the United States,
yep.
And they didn't give them tickets home. I mean, it was really, in retrospect, forced relocation.
Yep, and their homes were never rebuilt.
Yeah, the lower Ninth Ward to this day, which is the area where, you know, many working class African Americans lived and owned their own homes, it's been left to go to weed. Meanwhile, you have the French Quarter booming, the tourism district. Public housing in New Orleans. I was there when the city was still flooded, and already the lobbyists and the Republican politicians were talking about what a great opportunity it was. I quote one Republican lawmaker, a man named Richard Baker, who said 10 days after the storm, we couldn't clean out the public housing, but God did. And today in New Orleans, that public housing, which sustained minimal flood damage, is being demolished, is being replaced with condominiums and hotels. It's really a land grab. You know, it's a home invasion. People should be outraged about it. And I'm outraged that, you know, Barack Obama doesn't talk about it every day.
So then we get to 9/11.
Well, you know, 9/11, they used that to launch a new economy. A new economy on par with the dot-com economy or the information economy, and it's called the War on Terror.
What are its components?
Well, its components are privatized warfare, companies like Blackwater, privatized reconstruction, surveillance, privatized border control. Mm. All of this, you know, this has been the primary agenda and will be the most lasting legacy of the Bush administration, is that they have hollowed out the state and they've outsourced everything that they possibly can. So whoever enters the White House in 2008 enters a hollow house, a house that's really been looted before they even arrive. And, you know, once again, this isn't being talked about, and it's a huge shift. It's almost like a parallel shadow state that has been built with taxpayer money, and it's built with borrowed money, but it isn't in any way controlled by the public. And it's, you know, the company Blackwater is really the most striking case of this. And striking because, you know, we know about their scandals in Iraq, and they're accused of killing 17 civilians in a massacre. And yet they're still in Iraq because the U.S. government is so dependent on them that they can't stay in Iraq without Blackwater. Now, Blackwater got a taste of these super profits. This is a company that's headed by a man, Eric Prince, who openly said that he wants to do for the U.S. military what FedEx did for the post office.
Mm-hmm.
So he sees himself as, you know, this is just a continuation of the same ideological project that we've been living over since Reagan, right? And now Blackwater is diversifying. Blackwater sees new markets to expand into. They've just opened a base on the border with Mexico. in California, because they want to get into the border control business. So you think about all of this anti-immigrant sentiment being riled up in the U.S. by people like Lou Dobbs, you know, they're creating Blackwater's market for them. And Boeing's market. You know, Boeing got a contract to build a virtual fence on the border with the U.S. and Mexico, and also with Canada.
And meanwhile, I'm interrupting you, Naomi Klein.
That's fine. Please.
Guess what? The oil companies have moved back into Iraq because Hussein nationalized the oil companies. The Iraqi people owned them. Owned the oil, had the best education system in the Middle East, the best healthcare system in the Middle East. Now that's all been decimated, and on the sort of ashes of that decimation, move in Shell, BP, ExxonMobil, Total, and there's one other. And they went in for the oil, and they've now got it. They've stolen the oil. They're going to build 58 U.S. bases in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And they have constant surveillance, have camps and pick people up and probably torture them incessantly. So, Naomi, I'm interviewing you can see I'm just as worked up as you are because I've read your book, The Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein. Naomi, how do we stop this evil? And I can't think of any other word. Because as well as the globe heating up and we're about to lose one-third to one-half of the world's species in the next 100 years, apart from the ever-present threat of nuclear war, which could occur tonight, and meltdowns in nuclear power plants and the push for nuclear power, how do we stop this evil amongst human beings? How do we get the people to be educated when Generation X and Generation Y are on their iPods, they're texting each other, they're psychiatrically anesthetized because of this technology? Have you got any idea, Naomi, apart from writing your book and doing wonderful interviews?
Oh, God.
Because I guess I'm a doctor, I want a cure, an answer.
Yeah. I mean, the cure is understanding these tactics.
Yeah.
But the question is, how do we reach the people who don't read books?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that then we get into the corporate control over the media.
Yeah.
And how very difficult it is to break through in that way. Because, you know, all of these tactics, these strategies are about capitalizing on disorientation and regression.
Mm.
So once we identify them, their effectiveness is immediately reduced. It's really a law of diminishing returns, you know, for these tactics. But we do need to expose them. We do need to get it out there. And, you know, I don't know the answer. I'm doing my best. We're turning this into a film.
Good.
Because, as you know, films reach many more people than books. And, you know, I guess we all just need to just do everything we can to spread the word, because, you know, one thing that makes me really gratified is that, you know, in the United States, you know, sort of the belly of the beast, there's an enormous hunger for this information.
Yes.
And it's actually this message is very, very populist because people feel it and they're living it, right?
Yes.
The problem is it's not being echoed back to them either by their television sets or by their presidential candidates. And so one of the other things that people can do is put pressure on Barack Obama to make disaster capitalism a campaign issue, make the massive oil profits a campaign issue. Mm. And, you know, I think we just can't, we have to not give in to this sort of hero worship form of politics, of just sort of turning him into our savior and just hoping for the best. You know, he will be as good a president as people demand him.
That's right. And one last question, Naomi. Are you being well received by the corporate American media when you do your interviews? Are they receptive to you? You're beautiful, you're highly intelligent, they'll love you, but your message, how is that being received?
Honestly, like, you know, this book has done really well in the States, but it's really been despite the mainstream media, particularly television. You know, I've been on television just a few times. You know, I was on Bill Maher, I was on Oberman. Yeah. Besides that, nothing. I haven't been on CNN. I haven't been on any of the big networks.
Really?
It's just been they've completely shut the book out, despite the fact that it's been translated in 23 languages and all the bestseller stuff. They couldn't care less. You know, this is one of the things that's interesting. When it comes to ideas, they don't believe in the free market.
No. Did it get a good review in the New York Times?
You know, I did get very lucky. It was reviewed twice in the New York Times. Oh. And one review was absolutely vicious and called me a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah.
And the other review was by Joseph Stiglitz.
Oh, he's a lovely guy.
It was a very respectful review. Yeah, and that made a huge difference. It all makes a difference.
Mm.
But, you know, I can't complain because I'm getting so much more of a shot than so many other progressive writers in terms of getting these ideas out there. But it's still the process of getting on television, and, you know, I don't much enjoy it, but we are trying, is very, very difficult.
Well, Naomi, you're a Canadian Joan of Arc. That's all I can say.
It's been so much fun to catch up with you, Helen.
Yes, well, thank you, Naomi. I really, really appreciate it at the end of a long day for you. And so I guess we'll see each other around one of these years.
Definitely.
So thank you, Naomi.
Thank you, Helen. Take care.
You too.
Bye, everyone.
My guest today was Naomi Klein, award-winning journalist, columnist, and author of the new book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. Go to naomiklein.com to read more about Naomi. And I, as a physician, would definitely prescribe this book as mandatory reading for every single person that's listened to this program. You must give it to all your friends and relatives for their birthdays, for Thanksgiving, for Christmas, for Hanukkah, the whole thing. This book has to get out and be read by as many Americans as possible. In 2002, my niece, filmmaker Anna Bronowski, travelled with me to America and accompanied me on my annual lecture tour. Based on my work, Anna made a film called Helen's War, Portrait of a Dissident. I'm going to play an excerpt from the interviews Anna conducted to incorporate into the film. You'll hear from Martin Sheehan, followed by Lily Tomlin, then Senator Ted Kennedy, and finally the late Christopher Reeve.
What has happened is that we in the United States have considered it a foregone conclusion that the arms race has ended, therefore the threat of nuclear weapons has ended, and nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, the reverse is true. There are more people, unscrupulous people, with access to nuclear weapons now than ever before in the history of the nuclear age. And particularly with what's going on in the Soviet Union, they just can't afford to keep an eye on all of the weapons and materials to the extent that we do here. And not just the aging of the weapons, but the confiscation of them. And so that's a real concern. And yet, in the United States, we are still building new weapons and new systems of delivery. In fact, this president is determined to have a strategic defense initiative, which means Star Wars, which means weapons in outer space. Now, the absolute absurdity of that is clear if you come from outer space. Say you're a Martian or someone from another galaxy, and you come and you look at the situation on the Earth, and what you see around the Earth, all these nuclear weapons, and they're all pointed at the Earth. You'd have to think there was madness here, that it was a suicide mission, because it's like a gunman going into the bank and holding the gun to his head and saying, "Give me all your money or I shoot." That's what this thinking is all about. I didn't have a good thing to say, and none of us in the peace movement did have a good thing to say about Saddam Hussein. On the contrary, he was always a villain. There was never any question or doubt about where we stood on him, and still don't. But where was the United States or the West in condemning the use of chemical weapons against the Kurds or the Shiites in their rebellion in 1991? Who said anything during the war with Iran, you know? Well, the reason was clear. It was because we had an enemy in Iran at that time, and Iraq was warring on them, and so we were cheering and supporting Iraq just as we did Osama bin Laden in the war in Afghanistan. We're the ones that trained him and his group. I think that we live in a time and a place, and this is the belly of the beast. We are the new empire, and we can have as great a good upon the world and the future as we are for violence. It's just astonishing how the United States is still looked to as the great peacemaker in the world, as the great provider in the world. We still feed most of the world, and yet nations are trembling at the consequences of not agreeing with the United States or not supporting them, not joining in any alliance on whatever level it might be. They are going to pay dearly for that economically, politically, militarily. And so there's a lot at stake. Yeah. And we have to get in touch with the better angels of our nature now, man, because this is all coming from 9/11, you know, there's a great anger. And we're like a teenager striking out at anyone who gets close. And a lot of innocent people are getting clobbered in our paranoia. That's basically what it is. It's paranoia. It's not protection anymore. We're well protected. It's paranoia now.
When I first met Helen, and I heard her speak, I think at a big anti-nuclear rally, probably at the Hollywood Bowl or something, really huge, large, large audience, enthusiastic and committed to, the anti-nuclear movement. And Helen just is a standout. She was the person that seemed so informed, so passionate, and so committed that I became devoted to her. I wanted to do what I could to help her be seen and be heard and hopefully turn back the nuclear tide, if possible, and all the construction of plants in this country and around the world. And so my publicist at that time was a woman named Pat Kingsley, and the firm was called PMK. And I think Pat was exposed to Helen, and she had the same reaction. She became absolutely committed to Helen, and she did everything she could pro bono to get Helen out there into the public to be heard and seen. And several of us supported, you know, lent ourselves to create that visibility. In no way were we as conversant as Helen, and probably never will be, but I did it. Sally Fields was very much in support of Helen, and several others. I just immediately launched into whatever I could do. I read as much as I could. I studied as much as I could, and asked Helen questions and tried to become informed, just mainly so I wouldn't humiliate her by some ignorance on my part. And in the process, I began to see more and more how important she was to this planet. And so we would go on talk shows with her, and because as in all things in the media, it would be very hard for someone with a scientific background and that kind of a message to get that kind of mainstream exposure. It just doesn't happen every day and with any frequency. So if you bring along me and Sally Field and anybody else that has a profile like that, if things bog down, they can turn to me and say, "Oh, Lily, let's hear a little of that Ernestine," you know. And I go, hit a few of those off, and then Helen can get, you know, the audience would be back into it again.
But we are a small community. The world is. We are built and relied on world organizations, and they have been enormously important to the safety and security of the world. President Kennedy used to talk about making the world safe for diversity. The world can be safe and be diverse, but we have to work with our international friends and neighbors, and we're not always going to get our way. And I thought that the failure to understand that and work with our allies at the United Nations was a mistake, the idea of a unilateral kind of action. When it wasn't really the imminent threat that I think action would justify. And the fact is, we have the world community, as was working with the United States after 9/11 on terrorism, and this poses a great threat to the United States and many countries around the world. That has to be a first obligation, and it seemed to me that we were putting in danger that kind of cooperation and focus on it. And I think we are now in a very important position to require that we see the construction, reconstruction of Iraq. I think that's going to be incredibly important, and we ought to do that with the United Nations. Otherwise, I think the loss of the Arab world in this whole undertaking is potentially very dangerous. No one doubted any American that we could win the war. The real question was, were they going to win the peace?
I've always been someone who thinks that the whole nuclear energy situation in this country is very, very fragile. I'm also was made aware that these power plants, Indian Point in particular, they're very often very close to some kind of emergency. And we know we've had Chernobyl, we know we've had Three Mile Island, but also there are situations where there's been a close save many, many times, you know, when there's been a heating up of the cooling water to a dangerous level, or the water levels in the reactor get too low. And, I just think we were sitting with a ticking time bomb, and I think it is absolutely critical for anyone, whether they, no matter what they do for a living, whether a school teacher or a celebrated actor, they have an equal responsibility as citizens to say what they feel and to say it whenever they feel like it. The only difference is that the media is going to put a camera on the performer and not on the school teacher necessarily. That's just a fact of life. It's an unfortunate fact of life. But having said that, I think it is very important that performers, people who are well known, that they do speak out on the issues, but they must be thoroughly informed before they speak. In this present administration, in today's political climate, it's almost perceived of as undemocratic to speak in a voice of dissent. There's an environment right now where a wide-ranging debate is not welcomed, is considered somehow subversive. And again, you have to remember that democracy is only really healthy when everyone is talking. So I hope we get past this particular sticking point right now where it's not correct or not appreciated if people say things that are maybe not comfortable to hear. But I think whether it's in medical research or whether it's in dealing with issues of war or nuclear energy or education or healthcare or whatever, all voices must be heard.
That was an excerpt from Helen's War, Portrait of a Dissident. The excerpt featured Martin Sheehan, Lily Tomlin, Senator Ted Kennedy, and the late Christopher Reeve. If you'd like to get a copy of Helen's War, Portrait of a Dissident, go to www.r2r.ca, which is a website of Reel to Reel Productions. We'll see you next week on If You Love This Planet, and thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and edited by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.